This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 48. In this episode, we interviewed the participants of a panel at SP TechCon. I'm a developer, and why should I have to learn a new skill set? Recorded live September the 24th, 2014.
Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Windows Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, Exchange, Link, and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Chris Johnson.
And I'm Andrew Cole.
And we're just two dudes telling you how we see it.
All right, CJ, this is part two of our SP TechCon panel discussions wrap-up. How are you doing on this one?
Very good. Very good. How are you?
Doing good. We might as well just tip our hand to all of our listeners that we are recording these intros and outros back to back to back. So this whole thing about, hey, how are you doing today? And what's new? It's kind of like, well, there's nothing new in the last 30 seconds since we just wrapped the last one.
Yeah, exactly. Funny.
Yeah. The idea is just that we don't have an hour and a half or 2 hour long episode. I hate those podcasts that do that.
Yeah. Not so consumable.
Yeah. So we do have a couple bits of news that we held for this episode because this one's going to be more developer focused. So why don't you kick off some of our Azure news that we've seen that's come out lately?
Yeah, we've got a few goodies, right? We've got in the Azure space, there's role-based access control. I haven't dug in a whole lot into playing with this yet, but this is kind of something that a lot of people have been, you know, talking about wanting for quite a while and things like that. And it's kind of one of the many things that Azure has come out with kind of more recently, like with media services and some website improvements and all that sort of stuff. But should we go through each of them in order?
We just slam through like these three things. We can just mention them really quick. So like you were talking about the role-based access control.
People call it RBAC, right? Role-based access control. So let me just take a quick snippet here. Said, as people are moving more workloads to Azure, one of the most requested features has been the ability to control which cloud resources different employees can access and what they can perform on those resources. So it's kind of like, you know, an on-prem file shares, how you'd set up the permissions, for example, and you'd be able to apply groups and users and things like that to a file share and what activities they can do. Same kind of concept, right? It's the ability to control what people are able to access and what resources they can fiddle with.
Yeah, it's something that I know that as we're working through the startup curve that we're working on, that was one of the big requests that we had, a big feature we were going to add to it, and I still probably have something to it in the product. But we knew that Azure was working on this, and so it is nice to see. It's definitely nice to see this as an option that'll be available for customers.
Yeah, I think it's the most, like a really common request is, I've got 10 virtual machines in a subscription, and I want to let some people turn some on and off, but not others on and off.
Yeah, or I want to make sure that this employee can't go spin up a 56 gig VM that's going to cost a few bucks or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Another thing they added was some improvements to Azure websites. So one part is virtual network integration. It's going to allow you now to have your websites access resources attached to virtual networks. So in other words, you could have a website that's directly connected to a database hosted in a non-public VM on a virtual network. You also have this new scalable CMS with WordPress, what they're calling it. And it basically is saying that it's going to give you the fastest way to build an optimized and hassle-free WordPress site. This is kind of interesting because I have a friend that does a bunch of WordPress plugin development as a side business. And I know he has a couple challenges related to working with WordPress and Azure, because there's different databases and stuff that you can leverage with WordPress. So I'm not exactly sure how this changes what they had before, but hosting WordPress in Azure is one of the big challenges that he's always had to deal with.
Yeah, my blog runs on WordPress in Azure. Mm. And the previous sort of recipe or thing that you pressed out when you go create one of them, you end up with WordPress plus MySQL running off in some other, I can't even remember the name of the hoster who does it, but they host MySQL and they've done some sort of deal with Azure. And so when you go create a WordPress site in Azure, go create some MySQL database in some other hoster's cloud. And so I don't know if that's changing or if they're moving it to host the backend on SQL, maybe. I'm not sure.
It looks like it is, but it looks like it is going to be based on SQL. It's pre-configured to use Azure Storage. to store your media content, your media library, and you can very quickly configure it to do things with Azure CDN. It comes set up, pre-set up with stage publishing, SSL, web jobs, custom domains, autoscale, backup and restore features. So it's a couple things that are kind of pre-configured so that you can say, look, I want a website, and it just stamps it out and does a lot of the stuff for you that you can already manually go through. So it seems more to be, like you said, it's kind of like a recipe that has a bunch of auto stuff that it does off the bat.
Gotcha.
And then another thing that they did too is they also have some updates to website backups. So you can choose the destination of where you want the backups to go, like a specific storage account and a blob container if you're using Azure Storage. You can choose to back up your SQL databases or your MySQL databases that are declared in the connection strings on your WordPress site or your Azure website. These things, the backup things, are not WordPress specific. These are website specific. And on the restore side, this is pretty cool. You can restore to a new site, or you can restore to a deployment slot on an existing site so that you can verify your backup before you want to say, let's make this live. You can restore to a staging slot.
Oh, that's kind of handy.
Yeah, that's pretty slick. I like that.
Yeah, nice.
That's nice, yeah.
So the other one on Azure was some media services announcements, specifically around live streaming of video content and the ability to protect that content as well. So I don't know if you remember the Winter Olympic Games that happened, and the World Cup, the FIFA World Cup more recently. Mm. There was a bunch of streaming that was going on through Azure. And so some of those features that they'd developed and were using for those events are now available to anybody through media services in Azure. And so the first one is being able to stream live. So previously, you kind of had to upload your content into a blob and then sort of configure it, and then people could, on demand, go watch that video. Now you're able to go pump a live stream out through Azure and have people, you know, and then go deliver it to people in near real-time type thing.
Mm.
That's the first big one, which is really interesting because you think of things like events, right, where you want to stream, you know, a video feed from a conference room or from a session that's going on, or a breakout session or something at a conference. And this, that was really hard previously. You had to do it with something like Skype or Link or something else like that. And it wasn't a great solution for sort of really wide broadcast type capabilities. And so, so I think this is a really interesting feature for those kinds of scenarios where you can pump it out and people can watch it wherever they happen to be. And it's at a cost-effective way. Doing it for, I'll give you an example, doing it for the keynote of SharePoint conference when we've got execs on stage costs megabucks to do, right? Because you've got satellite trucks out the back and you've got people beaming things everywhere and you've got video feeds coming up to Redmond and getting mixed in the studios and then going out to the world through that. And so that will still be complicated, don't get me wrong, but it's that sort of scenario that will be able to be done by more people.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and the other one is being able to protect content. So if you want to, you know, make sure it's not just an unencrypted stream, you can slap a bit of DRM on there and piss some people off.
That's cool. So another thing that Microsoft announced actually very recently, like yesterday, was a new series of virtual machine that they've offered. So all the virtual machines that you've been familiar with, if you remember, they're all listed as different instances of like an A0 to an A9, and they have different tiers associated with them. What they just did is they came out with a new series called the D series. And the D series is much more of a high performance. And essentially what it is that you have much faster virtual CPUs that are available inside of these guys. They're actually roughly 60% faster than the A series. You can do more memory, up to 112 gigs. But the other thing that's really cool is that the other sizes all have access to a local SSD up to 800 gigs, allowing for a much faster read and write access. Now, these sizes go anywhere from, they start from a D1 all the way up to a D14, which is kind of funny because it's D1, 2, 3, 4, and then D11, 12, 13, 14. So we've
skipped a few.
Yeah, we've got a gap between, there's no D5 and there's no D10 or anything in between. But They're going to be available fairly soon for the standard tier. They're available now. The basic tier comes out later, and it's the same deal where, you know, basic is cheaper in the sense that you don't get the fault tolerance and stuff. This is going to make a lot of sense for people who are using the VMs for things that have a very high I/O read write. But if I'm not mistaken, the SSDs are more for temp drives, temp volumes. And so you wouldn't want to say, let me go create all of my databases over here and put them on these SSDs for these different size VMs, because when your VM shuts down and comes back up, you could be in a different server, and therefore your drives, your SSD volumes could be totally different. They could be temps. And so the data wouldn't be there. Hmm. Now, what they do make a lot of sense for is if you're using something like MongoDB and you've got replicated storage, or if you're using, I believe SQL 2014 has a capability called the buffer pool extensions, which allows you to use the drive as almost like a swap drive before it writes it to the database. So it's almost like a pre-cache kind of a thing.
Huh.
And you can leverage that inside of these new drives.
Gotcha, because that's speedy enough to deal with all the speed requirements for something like that they can meet, I guess.
Yep, exactly. Hmm. The size of these, or the pricing for these guys, they're, as you would expect, the pricing is actually not too far off from what I'm reading here. If you start at like a D1, which is one virtual CPU, 3.5 gigs, and a 50 gig hard drive, that comes out to about 17 cents an hour or $127 a month. That's for the standard D1. Mm. If you look at an A1, it comes out to about 9 cents an hour. So it's about half the cost. An A series is about half the cost of what this new D series is. The upper end on the D series is 16 virtual CPUs, 112 gigs of RAM, and an 800 gig SSD. That's going to bump you all the way up to around $2.61 an hour, or about $1,900 per month. Mm-hmm. And I'm basing these prices on the US Central Data Center. We know that the data center prices change. So it's cool. They got the nice high performance stuff. It's getting another offering that compares directly to what we have in Amazon's EC2 offerings, but now Azure does do SSDs. So that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet. I guess it sounds quite scenario specific, right? Like you might want to fire a couple of these big boys up for specific tasks and then shut them down.
Mm-hmm.
But know that for that time that you've got it, it's going to work really well and be speedy.
Yeah, it's something definitely to take a look at, but it's a very specific, like any of the VMs, you got to look at the use case of what you're trying to do. So
yeah. I'm not going to run my WordPress blog on it, let's put it that way.
No, well, you could. It could go nice and fast.
I think my blog would have to get a whole bunch more popular for that to be warranted.
Yeah, you're going to just make sure you crack the Amex.
Yeah, exactly.
Pull the sticker off. So the last thing that we had here about cloud-related news is Office 365 is free?
For EDU, yeah.
Oh, for EDU, yeah, for education, yeah. I see.
So this is, let me just put it this way. Now anybody with a qualifying EDU account, and I'll explain qualifying in a second. Anybody with an EDU account can go to a page and go sign up. They don't have to wait for their school or their university or whatever to go roll out everything to the students necessarily. Students can go sign up if they're a qualifying party.
Mm.
And there's some rules around who's qualifying and stuff, but the idea here is that, you know, they can go get 365, which includes the Office client bits as well. So they get Word, Excel, PowerPoint, all of that sort of stuff streamed down from the cloud. So it's a streamed service offering for the client bits. And they get storage and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, students with an EDU address can go punch it into a web page, see if they're qualifying. You know, the faculty or the school has some control over it.
Mm.
And it's part of the Student Advantage program, or an extension of the Student Advantage program, I think. And so they can go sign up for that, get Office, get storage, go put Office on their iPad or on their Mac. They get a terabyte of storage and access to Office Online. So that's all of the, you know, Word, Excel and PowerPoint and all that all through a web browser.
Mm. Very cool. So I'll tell you just two more little dev things before we jump into transitioning over to our panel recording here. One, if anybody's interested, another podcast called the Office 365 Developer Podcast. It's a Microsoft podcast. It's hosted by Jeremy Jeremy Thrake. I threw an R in his last name for the heck of it, apparently. And that's hosted by Jeremy Thrake. He and I sat down when we were at SP TechCon, and we talked a little bit about workflow and about some other stuff. That's episode 16. That went live last week. So that was, we had a really good discussion about workflow, securing web services for workflow, and just kind of bits and bytes, just ranting about some stuff. So it was a lot of, that was a lot of fun. And then I'm also was asked to be a guest on a another podcast, an Azure podcast called, well, it's called the Azure Podcast. It's hosted by three Microsoft guys. You can get more information about that podcast if you go to azpodcast.azurewebsites.net. I love that podcast. They do a really good job of kind of going over their content about new offerings and stuff inside Azure. So I'm going to sit down with them, I think, next week and do an interview. So it should go live sometime in October. So it'll be for our audience. I'm going to talk about just Azure from a developer or as a consumer developer point of view. And then I'm also going to talk about it using it for Office 365 based solutions as well.
Nice.
So let's go ahead and let's jump into this panel here. So what we did is this is called the developer panel. This panel was titled "The I'm a Developer, Why Should I Have to Learn a New Skill Set?" Office 365 introduces a new application model focusing on web development languages such as HTML and JavaScript to create app parts. Yet developers working with on-premises SharePoint are already comfortable using C# to create web parts. This was hosted by Jason Himmelstein, and the people on the panel were myself, Liam Cleary, Mark Anderson, Rob Windsor, Jeremy Thrake, and Christina Wheeler. I was able to hijack the majority of these guys and get them to come up to my hotel room where we sat down and kind of did a rehash of the panel. Jeremy was not able to join us. He was fighting a cold all week. And that day, he started sounding pretty poor. So he decided to opt out and not cough through it. And Christina couldn't join us as well because she was involved in the Women in Technology luncheon, which, no surprise, I was able to get everybody else on the panel since they were all men. So Christina couldn't join us. So it was just Liam, Mark, Rob, and myself with Jason as well. So why don't we go ahead and play that and we'll give our thoughts coming out the other side. All right, so here we are at Wednesday of the SP TechCon conference in Boston. We just finished earlier today, we did a developer panel discussion that I was also part of, but it was moderated by Jason Himmelstein. Was able to grab a few of the people that were on the panel. We lost two of them, one because of a conflict. Christina was involved in the Women in Technology luncheon. We're doing this at lunch, our lunch break right now. And we also lost Jeremy Thrake, who's pretty close to being on his deathbed. It would sound terrible on this podcast. So he bowed out, and I very eagerly said, yes, you shouldn't do this. So blowing out our microphone. So real quick, let's just go around the room. Let's just make sure everybody knows who was on the panel and who we have here. So I was on it. Andrew Connell, we got.
Rob Windsor.
Rob Windsor's with us.
Liam Cleary.
Liam.
Jason Himmelstein.
Jason.
Mark Anderson.
And Mark. So we got a pretty good cross-section of people that are doing different things that were on the dev panel. I know Jason is more on the IT pro infrastructure side. Mark does a lot of client-side development. Liam, very much on the security side. And Rob, we do all kinds of stuff, I guess. We're server side, client side, we do everything. So let's run through some of the questions and topics that came up. And we're not gonna rehash exactly what we all said in the room, because I know that they are gonna, they tried to record some of this, and some of the content is probably gonna be shown on a YouTube video by the conference. So we're gonna link to that in the show notes. So some of that content will get captured. But let's just kind of run through and like give some additional thoughts here. And that we might have after the show here. So the first question that came up, we had a guy that asked us a question about the new model of development and talking about, you know, this idea of building on, I like to rephrase it as building on top of or inside of SharePoint, how we've traditionally done it. And the other approach of, like, say, building beside SharePoint and building stuff that lives not so much inside SharePoint. And when I say that, I mean, like, you know, inside is doing like farm or sandbox solutions that have managed code in them. Building on top of SharePoint is maybe, you know, adding JavaScript and jQuery and using some of these cool client-side libraries to build stuff that lives on top of an existing SharePoint environment. Besides SharePoint would be the classic app model stuff that's living on the side, or if you have a custom ASPX page that's inside of a SharePoint site that you're going through and talking to SharePoint some way. We're not changing the UI of a list. So you guys had a lot of good experiences here. I know, Mark, you do a lot of more of the building on top of SharePoint and extending kind of what things are going on here. You had some pretty good points here and stuff. What do you think of, like, the way that this market is going? Where do you see with your customers of people that are, do they like this whole idea of not doing farm solutions and stuff inside of them?
Yeah, it's sort of a self-selecting crowd that comes to me. Mm-hmm. So people come to me because they know that I do things that way. But I think that the general message from Microsoft is a positive one. You know, we think that not putting code on the servers is a better way to build things than doing that, which has been the historical way of doing it. So we have lots of different options to build things that are not that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be an app model. It can be, you know, sort of the more traditional stuff that I've done. I mean, that's the same thing that you can do in 2007, 2010, or 2013. You don't have to necessarily swallow the whole app model idea fully.
Right.
But you have some more options through the APIs and by manipulating the DOM to build applications.
Yeah.
So I think it ought to be part of everybody's toolkit, regardless of what version you're on, too.
It is. You made a really good comment, I thought, at the beginning of the panel, where you said, you know, by the fact that I'm on the panel, you know, being Mark, you said, by the fact that I'm on the panel, this shows how much the development experience in SharePoint has changed. And I fully agree. I think, personally, that, you know, you got a lot of the most in demand, or the most, like, hot button kind of area of SharePoint in terms of, like, career development stuff is the stuff that you do, the stuff that like the Mark Rackleys and stuff do on the client side dev, because it's where traditionally the people like Rob and I and Liam, you know, they look at, like, the JavaScript stuff and it's like going, ah, geez, that stuff's terrifying, right? So, I mean, Rob, what are you seeing? So you've got a class that talks a lot about working with the CSUM and REST APIs, doing client side stuff on Pluralsight. You seeing the same kind of stuff, or do you have anything to add to this, or?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that's a problem in this space is, when we're talking about building beside SharePoint, is that people try to do what they did with solutions and collaboration in an app. And apps weren't ever really meant to be collaboration things. They're meant to be applications, like I'm building an expense tracking application or whatever. And the internals are really meant to be hidden from the users, not collaborated upon by the users.
Mm.
So I think, you know, people need to sort of understand what was the intent of the app model? How should I be using SharePoint-hosted apps or provider-hosted apps? And also, how should I be using sandbox solutions to do the things that are going to go inside of SharePoint as opposed to beside SharePoint?
Right.
And I think that's an area of confusion.
That's a really good point too, Liam.
I think that's an interesting point that Rob made, is that what we're finding with clients, and especially with our own devs, is that they would normally write full trust code, and then we're all being pushed, whether it's marketing or whatever it is, to use this app model, and then they're struggling to figure out how to make that into the app.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're being told to use client-side script, and then we're figuring out that, why would I need to build that way if I know that my client really is going to be using on-premises
mm-hmm.
for the next 5 years?
Right.
Why do I need to build something in an app just because Microsoft said we should build it in an app?
Right.
Because that's the way it should be. Whereas our devs, I know I've seen this for a lot of devs, they're fighting against that idea.
Mm-hmm.
I can write it in C#. It takes me 10 minutes. Now I've got to build a provider-hosted app with an app web and a bunch of JavaScript.
Just
a bunch of stuff, just because
yeah.
I'm being told that that's what I'm supposed to do.
Right.
But if we're building it for 365, then it makes sense.
Yeah.
But it is very much like, well, I want to replicate what I've got, but now I've made it twice as complicated.
Yeah, doing it just because that's what the
yeah.
marketing is saying.
Yeah.
That's a good point, Liam. Jason, you're coming from the infrastructure side,
yeah.
or the IT pro side. What are you seeing customers saying to this whole approach here? Are they very happy that the devs are being pushed out of SharePoint essentially and saying work on top of or work beside, ideally beside, I guess what they would really want us to do. What are you seeing?
So ultimately, part of it is future-proofing, and all of my customers always ask, so, you know, how is this going to sustain for 10 years? They all want the 10-year solution. In reality, it's the 3-year solution that they're going to get. But when looking at it, if they're moving into the app model and getting out of putting code on my servers, which is going to make my servers perform better to begin with, which is why I am a fan.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, you know, as the IT pro guy in the room, I like you guys having to push your code into another way because it, you know, it doesn't interact with my code on the servers. So But the customers are liking it because they're seeing it being future-proof. I get to make the decision, do I go Office 365, do I go on-prem? I'm at that pivot point where I'm having conversations right now with Microsoft's renewing my EA or whatever they're doing. You know, do I look to go to Office 365? Do I stay on-prem? Do I go into a hybrid solution? Mm-hmm. And if I'm going hybrid, do I get the opportunity to pick where I'm going to go regardless? You know, does this workload belong in Office 365? If I've written it in an app model, great. Mm-hmm. Then it can go either place.
Yeah, that's good. That's a very good point. Those are good points. Okay, so we had another question too that came up. I mean, it was a pretty, I think it was a fairly generic question. And, you know, it's the one of the whole, do I go on-prem or do I go Office 365? But then I know that there was another question that came up later that we'll come back to this a little bit later. But guys, Jason, you were the moderator of the panel, and you asked all the people on the panel, all of us, to say what's the coolest and sexiest thing? What thing is interesting to us these days that we're working on? And I know one guy in the room yelled out something that the way I understood him to mean was that he said, you know, just dev topics, don't talk about 365, which, I mean, I kind of looked at it and was like, yeah, I don't want to go here with the 30-second thing, but it was, to me, it was that's not an exclusive thing here. I mean, you can be a dev and take advantage of 365, at least I think you can, or I'm no longer a dev. And then same thing with on-prems. You can work in both of these environments here. You know, what are you guys seeing in terms of, like, you know, choosing the direction to go on, going on-prem or in Office 365? I think, Mark, you started with something about you don't just say, is it on-prem or Office 365? It's which, you know, what am I doing? What does it make the most sense?
Yeah, the decision about whether you should go to the cloud was really what I was talking about. You know, it's about the business requirements, about Microsoft uses the word workloads or use cases or whatever. I think that the you know, are you a dev when you work with Office 365 is an odd distinction. That I didn't actually hear that part, but you know, I think that
Jason was doing a good job of talking over him.
Yes,
when he started to say that. So I heard him say that. I'm going, I hope nobody else heard that. But
I think and the interesting thing is, from my perspective, the way I've been building things, I don't care that it's Office 365, because when I'm building a side or a top SharePoint, it's the same. I put my artifacts in a document library. I load some scripts in a page, custom CSS, whatever. I don't really care. The DOM is a little bit different. There are a couple of CSS classes I have to care about, but essentially it's the same thing. So depending on what development approach you've taken in the past, you may actually be able to do a lot of the same stuff that you've been doing on Office 365. I think it's the same thing is true, you know, the kind of dev that Andrew, you and Rob do as well, right?
Yeah, definitely does.
If we have time, I'd like to follow up on one thing you mentioned there, where the differences between the SharePoint Online, for example, the CSS you talked about, also the APIs are changing, and how do I, if I want to build something that's going to run both online and on-prem, how do I manage that with changing APIs, changing CSS, and so on? But I know that wasn't...
No, but then, you know what, though? This is why we're doing this, because you brought up something. I've talked to some people at Microsoft recently, and they asked me what are the three big things that I'm the most concerned about that I want to see them address. You just nailed number one, is you guys have to come up with a versioning schematic of how you're going to handle the API. How do I know I'm going to deal with this? Both, I referenced Azure and Salesforce. They have very clear ways of how they version their APIs. Same thing, if I'm working against something today and you've got a bug in the API, or I'm using a feature, however I'm using it, and I've worked around your bug in version 22, but now you've published, you're actually on version 27 or 37. I'm actually using the Salesforce. So if I've actually worked around, if Salesforce is actually running on 37 as the latest one, and my code still works on 22 because I haven't told it to use the fixed version of the API, I'm still using the buggy version of the API that I've developed a workaround for. Yes, yeah, so I agree. That's a big thing that would help us a lot with these on-prem and 365 solutions.
That's why the SOAP web services are so wonderful. They don't screw with them.
Well,
I don't think that's... that's not the official engineering term,
Yeah. Well stated by the SP services, gentlemen, yes. On the right. Liam, you had something to add to the original.
Yeah, I think it goes along with what Mark was saying, that it really... So Mark obviously focuses more building over the top and using the client-side stuff, but when you're building stuff on the other side, because a lot of the dev that we get involved in is not that.
Right.
That's just, we have the UX team that go ahead and do that. But when we're building a fully fledged solution, it really choosing which platform to go with really dictates what that solution is actually going to be.
Right.
If I'm trying to connect to a line of business application in my office location, then putting it in, connecting and writing something to 365 suddenly becomes way more complicated than building something on premises.
Yeah.
And so we have the hybrid story, but it doesn't quite work the way that you want it to work. A lot of the stuff we've done is bring in transactional information, stuff, even if you're doing BI and bringing BI in, I want to surface it in 365, but it's on-prem.
Yeah.
Now you're getting into that complicated story of not everybody has an infrastructure team that can build a hybrid scenario to make that work. Not everybody can write the code that's needed to make that work.
Right.
So they rely on the old way of doing it because they know it works. And I don't need to worry about 365
right.
at all.
That's a good point.
I'm not against 365.
Right.
I just, from what I've seen, you don't have to use it. That's the key.
It kind of goes back to what you were saying before. I'm not going to build these solutions as an app just because they have to be built as an app.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go to 365 and go to 365 just because I'm going to 365. Can I create one of those solutions or I hate these words, I'm creating a solution, but I'm not talking WSP. I'm talking about an answer to a problem.
Yeah.
But can I build a solution in the cloud that talks to a line of business app in a secure way using Service Bus and Direct Connect, stuff
key.
Like that? But it's like, I can, but I don't have to.
But that's the key. Security comes in,
and
you expect your end client to know how to configure their infrastructure securely so that you can utilize Azure services or 365, and lots of people just don't know that, and there's not enough documentation for that.
Totally agree. Rob, you got something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, Liam mentioned hybrid a couple times, and I think that that's one thing that even though there's a lot of problems with hybrid, it still has to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people just think it's on-prem or cloud, and they don't ever even think about the hybrid scenario. So, that's just something to always keep in the back of your mind, is that that is an option, even though there's a lot of warts with it right now.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. So let me ask you this. I'm going to jump ahead. Well, we have another question that came up during the panel. Someone asked, where do you put your data? I'm gonna pass on that question because, we've been asking that same question. It keeps coming up since 2007. I don't think that answer's really changed. I think it's still basically the exact same thing. At least I do. I mean, do you guys feel the same way? It's like, where do I put my data? Do I put it in SharePoint? Do I put it as a SharePoint list? Do I put it in a database? Do I build a separate app? Do I? Wrong?
Yeah, just the one thing that I mentioned that a lot of people don't know yet is that now with SharePoint Online, when you delete SharePoint hosted app, that it goes in the recycle bin, it doesn't just go away. So your list data isn't gone.
Yeah.
So that will, I think, change that decision matrix. Just wanted to make that point.
Liam?
So for me personally, I'm not a great fan of using tons and tons of lists and trying to make everything join together because SharePoint wasn't designed to be a relational database. We actually have a pretty good product for that.
Yeah.
That does that really, really well.
Is that a relational database?
I think it's a relational database.
That's a good name.
It's this new spangly thing that's come out.
Gotcha.
You could even use one in Azure as well. Always on, failover, the whole thing.
That's really good. Maybe like a SQL database.
Yeah, kind of a SQL database. Yeah. but it's that. I mean,
check the box for the Azure entry podcast. There we go.
Done. but it comes back to that. Like, I kind of err on the side of, if your end user, like Mark said, I think earlier, that if the end user needs to update stuff and use lists that they're used to, then build some of the stuff into SharePoint lists in the app, into the code.
Yeah.
If they have no need for that and you need to scale and you need better performance, then don't build it in SharePoint just because you're used to using SharePoint. I know the whole building block thing and everything else, and it's great, but we have other things that we can actually use. And getting away from SharePoint dev, I know it sounds really bad, but you really are getting away from SharePoint dev. That's the whole point.
I think that's the whole point of the app model, right? It's like, first, I think that we're going to tag you as the just because guy right now. Is that the third point?
Yeah, sorry.
But I think, I agree with you. I think the whole point of it is to get out of SharePoint. When I'm hiring people for my projects now, I'm not looking for a SharePoint guy. I'm looking for an HTML, CSS, JavaScript. Are you good with talking to RESTful services? Are you good with OAuth? That kind of stuff. That, I think, is what's important today and everything. It's cheaper. We go to Jason here. Jason had something to say.
Yeah, so Rob and I both played in a little bit in the space around Lightswitch. You and I had a 2 years ago conversation where it was, that's never going to take off, which is exactly where things are starting to look these days. So the fact that you can do, like Rob usually does in his session, back it in the SharePoint list, and personally I'm a fan of doing it in a SQL Server database because, heaven forbid. But yeah, being an infrastructure guy, I get to build more. going down that path is where if I'm putting data in and I'm not putting documents, I'd rather put things into a SQL Server database as well. So.
Rob? Yeah, so I think if you're building a provider-hosted app that has its own custom backend, then getting a web dev or an ASP.NET dev or whatever it happens to be that doesn't really know SharePoint is perfectly fine. But if you're building a SharePoint-hosted app or a provider-hosted app that's going to talk back to SharePoint through the client object model, those people need to understand how SharePoint internals work.
Yep.
You know, you can't just say, I'm just going to get a traditional web developer and let them, go and do that, because there's so many pitfalls that are potentially there that, you don't want to have to basically have that person walk through that minefield. Right?
Right. That's a really good point there. That's a really good point. Lee.
I kind of go along with Rob, and I kind of see it as if you're trying to extend functionality in SharePoint, then it would make sense to build stuff the SharePoint way.
Yeah.
You know, I want to add ribbon functionality. I want to have app parts that do stuff. But if I'm building an application that really has nothing to do with SharePoint, but I want to surface it in SharePoint, which would be the app model, then it makes sense to utilize other services. Go and use the MVC frameworks. Go and use SQL Azure databases. Go and use all of that, and don't spend the time worrying about the SharePoint apart from using it as a presentation layer.
Mm.
Because it really is down to that.
Yeah.
Like, is it a fully fledged? Is it a fully fledged app, or is it just I'm extending it?
Yeah, my piece.
At that point, it really just becomes an extended link.
Yes.
It's a link with a link plus plus, like
with the super page view of web app.
Yeah. So we've gone a good bit here. Let me just go into one more question we had at the very end. We had two more questions. So one was about regulated businesses. And how you deal with that, but I'm not so sure that's so much of a dev topic. So I'm gonna let that one kind of punt a little bit here.
The one topic we can talk to. No. Keep going, Nancy. Keep going. Let's go.
Thanks for being here, Jason.
You can talk. The last one I wanted to go to is Jason. You asked a question at the very end here. This is where you actually get an answer, because you asked the question, you didn't actually get a chance to answer it. But you said something along the lines of, "What are you most interested in these days? What is piquing your interest? What do you like to play with in the SharePoint space, or just in the technology space right now, around the business side of it, right? It doesn't have to be a SharePointy thing. It doesn't have to be an Office 365 thing. We are all in the Office 365 and SharePointy world, and generally we're doing SharePointy and Office 365 based solutions that we're doing these days. What are you working on today that you enjoy working on, that it's like, I really hope that I get to do this on this project or something? Not that you're trying to force it in, but what are you liking to play with? Mark, I'll let you jump in and go first.
Well, my answer during the panel was I'm doing a lot with Knockout. I'm having a lot of fun with that. But I think even just based on the conversation we had afterward, it's all of the stuff that's out there now that we can use, these frameworks, plugins, toolkits, whatever the words are, that we can bring together in order to bring, those building blocks that we can bring together on the client side to build some really cool UI.
Yeah.
And therefore, things that real people actually enjoy using.
Yeah.
Which is not always what SharePoint is.
Yeah.
That's exciting stuff.
I agree. And that, there's a good resource I found. I'm doing presentations totally different this week using this thing called Reveal.js that I stumbled across. Similar, it's not a SharePoint thing. It's not really applicable in a SharePoint space, but it's similar to what you're saying. It's one of these cool libraries. I will say, if people are looking to say, how do you stay on top of all that stuff? There's a part, if you go to GitHub, create an account at GitHub, you can sign up for a weekly newsletter of the most popular repositories this past week. And it's the same repositories don't keep showing up every week. It's a new list, like, here's what came up this week that got really popular. And it's kind of neat to get that and just look at the top 10 that came through and just like, let me click on and see if one of these is applicable to what I'm doing. So, Jason, what about you? What's kind of got you interested these days?
Well, there are two different things. I actually spent some time with Dan Holm at a previous show before I flew in here last night, talking about the fact that I've been wanting to launch a PowerShell community for SharePoint IT pros. We're going to get that out there on Unity, IT Unity at some point, and then not too distant future. We keep saying that, but it will happen. We have commitment. There's a couple things that need to get tweaked in order to make it happen. But the ability to do PowerShell that works not only with your on-prem world, but the Office 365, Azure, the whole nine yards, be able to interact in all spaces, be able to help people understand that for my ilk, for the IT pros, it's the thing they have to learn. Mm. It's what we have to do in our world is shifting. It's no longer, I'm gonna go rack stack servers and build and do all of this.
Yeah.
It's okay, from an administration perspective, we have to learn how to live in this new world. As your world is changing, so is ours. And the other one that I'm enjoying is I still love playing with all the fun BI stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, Power BI is tricky and fun and interesting. And
yeah, an innovating space for them. That's been a lot of space there. How about you, Liam?
I spent time playing with Linux.
Oh, there you go.
hacking Wi-Fi networks and things like that. But for work stuff, I obviously sit in the security and identity kind of space. Mm-hmm. And there's been some really good advancements over the past couple of years for Office 365, on-premise. Just the idea of moving to this, you know, great advancements to SAML authentication and moving across. So spending time with clients, helping them understand that it's not as simple as installing SharePoint and hey presto, you can authenticate anyone.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite work that way.
Yeah.
But then building solutions that say, well, I want my environment to authenticate against something completely random that may not even be .NET based at all, but figuring out how that works.
Wow, that's cool.
And that seems to work really, really well, building the Identity Foundation stuff. And I know the stuff that Microsoft are building in the 365 cloud with Azure AD and everything else. Great stuff to play with.
Yeah, you are the guy, we're gonna put this in the show notes. I gotta remember to do this because you have a session that you do that you've done at a couple of big conferences around hacking SharePoint. And it, I don't know if everybody has seen it, but it is a terrifying session, right? As a developer that builds stuff, it's a terrifying session because I'm just like, oh my God, every environment I've stood up is gonna get, Liam's gonna destroy me. So you're the guy that I always want to have in my sessions when I'm going to present something to people and saying, like the thing I'm gonna go present right after this session about single page ads. I'm like, look at this cool way to go through and to build things inside SharePoint. I want you in the room to one side to tell, you know, say like, oh yeah, but you gotta think about this, you gotta think about this. These are new vulnerabilities that you've gotta deal with and stuff. But the other side, I'm terrified to have you in the room because I'm afraid I'm gonna be suggesting something to people that are gonna be like, oh my God, Liam's like, this is a terrible idea. You shouldn't do this at all.
I would never say that to you.
But well, no, not in public. You'd say it after everybody starts coming down and burning down the houses. I knew that was a bad idea. Yeah.
I mean, one quick thing to throw in the session that I gave, I taught the Hacking 1 at Dev Connections.
Uh-huh.
And in the session, we found a SharePoint site, just looking online. The all site content was open, and we found a list that was called user accounts that had user accounts in, and I could edit the password for those accounts as an anonymous user.
Oh, you're kidding
me. So that kind of gives you an idea of the mistakes that people make and the people that we're working with.
Did you find that ahead before the session or during the session?
I found that one about 30 seconds before I was just testing in the session. I was like, I will use that one.
Did you show
it? Yeah, live in the session.
Oh my, could they tell what the company was?
Oh yeah, it's all in big letters. And I even found the company that made the SharePoint website. They're a SharePoint shop that make hosted SharePoint.
Oh dear God.
But we'll leave it at that for now.
Let's just say that I don't want a liability issue. We don't have a lawyer watching the show, so that will not be in the show notes. Which
one it was. Yeah, this website, this account.
Yeah. Rob, how about you? What are you looking at these days?
I just want to say, I've seen Liam's hacking SharePoint session twice, and I saw the thing with the user accounts. But even every time I talk to Liam, he finds a different way to scare the crap out of me. It's like,
that's just a personal thing.
I'm scared to have a device that connects to the internet anywhere near him. But anyway, that aside, the thing that's been, like, I've spent probably more than the last year really focusing on JavaScript. 70% or more of the code I've written in the last year and a half has been JavaScript. And trying to understand JavaScript as a language and how to write enterprise JavaScript is a term that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So JavaScript in a way that I'm working in a team, I have a large code base, I want this thing to be maintainable, I want it to be readable. I don't want to fall into all the issues that people have when they have large JavaScript code bases. So it's really the first language I've learned in, geez, 10 years anyway.
Yeah.
So it's been very interesting.
It's a language that I think I said during the panel that 2 years ago, I hated it. I absolutely hated JavaScript and did everything I could to avoid it because I knew I hacked my way through it all the time. But once, I think it was early 2013, I started really spending more time with this stuff and looking at the more enterprise-y level stuff, the way you should be doing, not be doing, putting things in a global namespace and doing, you know, self-executing functions and closures and stuff. The more I spent time with them, I'm going, man, this is really flexible. And then I switched back to a C# project. I'm like, damn it, this is a little restrictive. And I wanted to go back. And that, I mean, to me, that was my answer, was that I've enjoyed it so much that I've also, I got really intrigued around late 2013 when you started to see all of these press releases coming out from companies like Walmart and Netflix that were switching their entire shop to a Node.js solution. And, you know, at first it was kind of like going JavaScript on the server, you guys are crazy. But then you hear like what Walmart went live with a whole new e-commerce system on Black Friday and had 20% the performance. The servers were working 20%
less.
So it's a good 20% is a good number. It's not 80%. 80% would be like they had an 80% reduction in the amount of load that was on the servers just by switching over to Node. That blew me away. And then just seeing how more people jumped into it, then I started playing with it. It's like, I actually do have a language that I can write all the same stuff in the client now on the server, both even on Windows or on OS X or on Linux. I mean, it's
Raspberry Pi.
And on Raspberry Pi. So good fun.
And I just, for developers who are transitioning from managed code over into JavaScript code, and they want to speed up that process a little bit, I suggest people take a look at TypeScript.
Oh yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, it's a way that you can write code more similar to what you're used to writing than emits JavaScript code, and lets you learn how to, you know, do I do object-oriented programming, JavaScript, and all these kinds of different things. So it's great.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. Cool. Well, gentlemen, thanks a lot for taking time out of your lunch break to come talk and do this. This is definitely going to be really valuable to our listeners, and I really do appreciate you guys taking the time to do it. So Rob, Liam, Jason, Mark, thank you very much.
Glad to do it. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks.
All right. So that was the outtake of our panel that we had at SP TechCon. Again, that was the I'm a Developer, Why Should I Have to Learn a New Skill Set panel. Everybody in the room on that panel was a developer, except for Jason Himmelstein, who's the moderator and is coming from the IT pro side, which was nice because we get the other side of, you know, what did they think about all of us being pushed in this new world?
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts after, you know, when you listened to our interview?
Yeah, there were two things that sort of stood out to me. One was Jason's comments about get your filthy code off my servers, which I thought, well, I'm not quoting him, but that's my paraphrasing, which I thought was kind of interesting because, you know, that's part of the motivation for the new way of building stuff is more stability and more security and more manageability and keeping things up and running and smoothly. So that was kind of interesting because, you know, coming straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And so I thought that was an interesting comment. And then the other thing that really stood out for me was the sort of the opposing views between Liam and Mark.
Yep.
You were saying things quite contrary to one another, I thought, at least anyway. And maybe I've misread it, but, you know, on the one hand, Mark is saying, hey, I don't care. I just build stuff the way I build stuff and it runs anywhere. And I don't know what you guys are going on about this on-prem versus the cloud thing. Like, my stuff doesn't change.
Yep.
And then, you know, and then Liam was like, yeah, but why would you do that when it's going to take longer and things, when you can just do some full trust code and get it done real quick and, you know, things like that.
Mm.
And so I thought that was interesting opposing views, right? And I think that for me, the line is somewhere in between them.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think, sure, there are certain situations where FTC is still your only option, but there are lots of reasons why you should consider not doing it too. Just for flexibility, right? Of, hey, you might not feel like moving to the cloud now, but what happens if you want to move to a hoster that has stricter full trust code deployment rules or something like that, right? It's not just about 365, but it's about good software design in general.
Yeah.
But then I also, but also I get his point that sometimes you need more control than what you can get with putting, you know, completely front end app. So,
yeah.
But I just thought that was an interesting kind of thing. One thing I almost snorted with laughter is when Liam was like, yeah, but if you want to build like a real solution. And I was like, oh my God, is Mark going to reach over across this panel and throttle him?
You know, it was funny listening to that because I've kind of come full circle on that whole subject where, you know, 2 years ago, I would have told you that I absolutely hate JavaScript. I despise it. I'm not a fan. I, you know, whatever. I wanted my C#. I wanted my managed code. And, you know, I think, God, in the last 2 years, lately, I have been doing a significant amount of client-side stuff and very little server-side stuff. The server-side stuff is really just there for the glue for the things that you can't do client side. So like protecting an access token or doing some sort of data access that I need to do server side and not...
Or background task or something.
Yeah, or background task.
This is also the other thing that is kind of weird is like people think that the new world is only JavaScript and HTML.
Yeah.
And that's so far from the truth, it's not funny, right?
Yeah.
It's like, sure, there's been a shift, right? And that stuff is far more important than it was in the past. But you can still have your C# that you compile.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't run it on the server.
Yeah.
Right? You run it in your own environment.
Yeah, and that's something that I was trying to explain during the panel was that, you know, you don't have to live exclusively in one spot. I think stuff that Mark does, I think that his role is fairly unique in that he can play only in the client and not care at all about what's going on the server. But there is the need also for doing stuff on the server side. And this new world, I guess, and to coin more of the, to steal a phrase that he either came up with it or at least he uses it a lot, but that Scott Hillier uses, this new world, again, to me, it's only a new world in the sense of Office 365 and SharePoint, because this world has been really old hat to the web world, but it's really this new world of web development is client over HTTP. And that can be literally running in the client, or it can be having a server component that talks to some other client, like 365 can be a client from my MVC website running on-prem or in Azure. So it's nice to kind of get these two different perspectives on things. I saw that to be a big theme at SP TechCon and a lot of questions during the panel. There were two things that did come up during the panel that I thought were worth mentioning. One was that when at the very end, Jason asked a question about, you know, in about 30 seconds or less, what technologies are you enjoying playing with these days? And not so much what are you working with these days, but what are you enjoying playing with these days? And one guy in the audience, or before we got a chance to ask it, he yelled out, focus on the dev, don't go 365. I would have loved to have said this during the panel, but I didn't want to say it because I didn't want to single out one individual in the room and have people kind of looking over at him. But if by chance he's listening to the podcast, this is not a slam on you. This is just, to me, this is the way you need to think about this. They're not different.
Mm.
You don't need to treat them as two different entities. You can do dev on 365. Your stuff just doesn't run inside of a SharePoint process. And from my point of view, as someone who's been doing this now for over 11 years, working with SharePoint over 11 years, who advocated just a few years ago that you should be building inside or on top of SharePoint, now this new model of building beside SharePoint and communicating with it, I personally like it as a developer a significant amount more than the old way of doing it, because 365 or on-prem SharePoint can do whatever they want to do. And as long as they're doing a good job with the versioning of the services, which they're not doing today, but I know that's something that they need to pay attention to, that they recognize that they need to pay attention to on the engineering side, but they can do whatever they want to do. And I can build whatever I want to build using any technology on any infrastructure. And I can use any of the latest and greatest new stuff. I like the flexibility. I like the ability to use whatever tools I want to use. I like the fact that, you know, these days I can play with Node.js and I can write SharePoint applications or Office 365 apps. But it doesn't matter as far as SharePoint's concerned. I can do whatever I want to do. It's a freedom kind of a thing. So I don't think that point that you can say, focus on this, don't focus on that, like going, that's not really fair, because I build for 365 now. I build almost everything I do now for 365, knowing that it's almost always going to work on-prem. If I go the other way, I got a lot more stuff to worry about.
Oh, yeah, totally. I actually feel like developers, I think people are struggling with this, but overall, I think once you get into it, developers feel a lot freer, right? They feel they've got more choice and flexibility, like you said, on how they do it and what they do it with. But it is different, right? I do get that change is hard and that it takes a while. People to grok it and understand it and things like that. So it's no surprise, but I definitely feel like overall being a SharePoint dev is no longer a point in time career decision.
No.
Right? You had to really decide, I'm going to be a SharePoint dev a few, 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And then you'd be a good one after a couple of years, maybe.
Yeah.
And then you'd be an expert maybe in another year or two after that.
Yeah.
And now it is much more open to other people, to getting involved from a dev point of view. You can use all the tools and libraries and all that sort of stuff you want to use. And it's just more accessible to more people. We're not those weirdos that have like developer sessions just for them.
Yeah.
I want to be able to go to any Scott Hanselman session and then walk back and build whatever he was talking about and plug it into SharePoint.
You know, people started to pick up on that message at SB TechCon. I had a bunch of sessions that were around that topic, had a bunch of conversations with a lot of the attendees. As someone who has been in that full trust world for so long, I like making the transition to this other world where I'm just like, SharePoint is now to me a provider of capabilities and services. It's not an app dev platform. Some stuff that they have to offer is going to be great inside of my custom applications, but there's also a significant story for using it straight out of the box for the vast majority of the customers that are out there. But I'm not going to go through and try and change it to work the way I want it to work. I'll add my own stuff that takes advantage of it. And I now only have to really focus on what are the out-of-the-box capabilities and what does the API look like? So as long as I can understand how to talk to a REST API, or if I have to deal with the work with a CSOM, that's just a personal preference there. And I understand how to deal with apps and OAuth, then I feel much freer. It is very much like when you've seen the Matrix, it's very much when Neo sits there and red pill or blue pill, and you can keep doing what you're doing, that's fine. But there's this other world that I think it is much more free and much more flexible. I get why people are scared to go there or why they dismiss it and think that it's a bad thing to go there from the SharePoint world.
In my SharePoint or loser keynote, I described it like the book of Who Moved My Cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, Mike Fitzmaurice has used this a few times. He's hilarious at it. But yeah, I think it's like, you know, you talk about red pill, blue pill. It's not like a major life decision, right? It feels like that to people, like, oh my God, I'm going to change this whole thing. But it's realigning with the way the rest of the world works and the way the rest of the dev world works and participating. And so now you can go to a dev conference that's purely a dev conference and they don't look at you like you're that weird SharePoint guy that works on that black box that nobody understands and that you can play in their world. And I think it makes a big difference. But, you know, hey, I'm biased. I work on it every day.
Yeah. Hey, so to wrap one thing, let me ask you, I'll repeat what Jason asked me. And just out of a little fun, I'll ask you this. So Jason at the very end said, what technology are you playing with these days that you really enjoy working with? So it's not what you have to do for work. It's not what you have to do on the current project. But if a project came along and they said, you know, you can use whatever you want and it doesn't have to be this makes sense. This is just I'm going to make this work.
Yeah.
What technology would you use? For me, I said I was having a lot of fun living in the Node.js world. I'm trying to build a reference, trying to take this project I did that's in the Office Dev site. And it's a single page app that is running with a intermediary ASP.NET MVC/Web API backend. I'm trying to take that intermediary and switch it to 100% Node.js running on Azure just because and just for fun. And oh my God, I love Node.js. I love the fact that the one language, the tools, the syntax, the theming, the testing, everything I'm doing in the client, it works pretty much the exact same way on the server. I'm loving it.
I'm completely ignorant to any of that stuff. Like I totally understand what it does and kind of, you know, the space it plays in, but never done it myself.
Yeah.
But it fascinates me.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
How about you?
I have this strange sort of affliction, that's not the right word. I'm very drawn to Xamarin right now.
Uh-huh.
And that's partly twofold. One, because I've not played with it before. And two, but I'm very keen to learn more about building native apps cross-platform without having to rebuild the wheel every time.
Are we going to get a My Trips on iOS?
Nervous laugh.
Can we get a My Trips on iOS? Can you start a Kickstarter for some of us to start giving you money to start building this?
That's going to be my test project, yeah.
Woo!
So I don't know if it'll ever come out for iOS. Hey, but so my motivating factor is that Concur recently got sold to SAP.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you know, but TripIt, which MyTrips talks to, TripIt.com is owned by Concur, which is now owned by SAP. And I'll go out on a limb and say that, like, you know, SAP is not known for its great sort of consumer-facing software, right?
Yep.
Is that politically correct enough?
I think it was perfectly fine. Nothing to censor here.
And so, you know, I don't know what the future of TripIt's going to be. Hopefully they'll keep it running. I really do. I think it's a great service. But it sort of spurred me into thinking, well, like, interesting. So why don't, like, I wonder if they're going to stop shipping the TripIt client for iOS at some point. I guess that there's too many people to stop doing that. Mm-hmm. But coming back to the Xamarin stuff, like, I want to play around with seeing how much of my code from my Windows Phone app I can get running on an iPhone.
Yeah, it's Xamarin's pretty cool. I've got a friend who used to be a Microsoft evangelist out of Tampa who is now a Xamarin evangelist who is going crazy trying to get me to go to, I think it's Xamarin Evolve in Atlanta sometime in October.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I was like, is it, can you make it? It's like, no, I can't make it. He goes, what if I knock 70% off the registration for you? I'm like, I still can't make it, but it really sounds more appealing now.
It's ludicrously cool technology.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think people really get it. Like, unless you've looked at it, you're like, holy shit, that's mind-bending.
Yeah.
How does that work? And I just love it. I'm a C-sharp guy. I want to be able to write stuff that runs on iOS.
Yeah.
And Android.
Yeah.
And Windows Phone.
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty cool.
I just want them to have the studio have the same support for projects that Visual Studio has. So I'm on a Mac and I have Xamarin Studio, and I love being able to open up a Visual Studio project, Visual Studio solution inside the Xamarin Studio on the OS X side. But then there's always a couple little apps that just kind of pop in. They're just like, or a couple little project types, like, I don't know what this Azure project type is, or I don't know what this SharePoint type is.
I see.
But I tell you what, man, you look at their UX,
yeah,
and there's things that Visual Studio guys could learn that are like, you look at it and say, when you're looking at all the NuGet packages, it shows in a little, you know, opaque text right next to the NuGet package. It says, update available 3.4 or something like that.
Ooh,
so you can,
yeah, that'd be sweet.
Yeah, you can visually see what's missing. So,
in all honesty, I've looked at it. I've read a little bit about it, but I haven't actually done anything.
Yep.
So next step is to try it out. Unfortunately, when I wrote the original version of My Trips, I did in a very hastily fashion. And let's just say it's not exactly MVVM friendly.
So, got some work to do on the refactoring side.
I got a little refactoring to do. The good side is I basically rebuilt my trips for Windows 8. They're two separate code bases. And the one on Windows 8 is completely MVVM based. Mm. So I might be starting from that code base as opposed to my phone code base. Mm. And then rebuilding the phone app for iOS. Ah. But we'll see how it goes. I mean, in typical fashion, I am not committing to a release date or actually releasing it at all. It's more of just a test at this point.
Gotcha. Well, I'll be a tester for you.
Yeah, I'll give a shot. That's kind of how the phone app started, right? It was like I just wanted to try phone development for myself, and then enough people asked for it, I had to stick it in the store.
Very cool. All right. So let's go ahead and wrap this one. That's part two of our panels. Our last panel we got is the InfoPath panel. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening in, and hope you got something out of this episode.
Thanks.
If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or MP3 and provide a link so we can play your question on the show. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find full transcript and show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.